Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppins.
My name is Kathleen McGowan. And today on The Spirit Revolution is all Philip Coppins all the time, because Philip has been extremely busy out in the world of spiritual revolutionaries, and he has a lot to say. So, my dear, you spent the last week at a very, very interesting conference in beautiful Glastonbury called Megalithomania. This is something that you have done in the past. First of all, tell us a little bit about what Megalithomania is.
Well, Megalithomania is a two-day conference in Glastonbury, which was started by a group of people, specifically John Martineau and Hugh Newman. And they were inspired by a title which was created by the late John Michel, who always was very close to this phenomenon of megaliths, and also to the conference as such, because up until his death 2 years ago, John Michel was one of those people who was always there. And even on Sunday, at the second day of the conference, there was his former partner, Christine Roan, was there. And John Martineau, one of the founding members and still co-organizers of the conference, and basically gave a lecture to explain to the audience who John Michel was. And to just give our listeners a very brief overview, who might not know who John Michel was. John Michel was an Englishman, I would say a typical Englishman, who in the 1960s realized that there was more between heaven and earth than the things which were commonly listed in books. And specifically, he began to look in geometry and sacred architecture and how all of these things were related. He wrote wonderful books. I think his most accessible book is probably a very good guidebook to the sacred sites of England, which you might still be able to find on things like A-Books. Sacred Guide, I think, to England is the title of that book. But he wrote various books, and probably his most famous book is called New View Over Atlantis, in which he relates some of his stories as to how he felt that the Earth in the past was mapped, and how our ancestors, specifically our Druid ancestors, our megalithic ancestors in Western Europe, possessed information and knowledge of the places they lived in, which far exceeds anything which archaeologists are willing to credit them with. And in one book, which has been re-edited, which originally, I think the original title was called The Center of the World, he goes into a very detailed analysis of islands, like Ireland, the Isle of Man, some of the islands of the coast of England, Wales and Scotland, and of Britain as a whole, and as England as a whole. And he finds that our ancestors were actually able to plot the center of these islands, whatever they were, extremely detailed. And now we know, of course, about Ireland and how it is divided into the four regions and how the sacred division was always there. Michael Dames wrote a wonderful book about that. But really, he made sure by demonstrating that it wasn't just Ireland, but that this was a recurring pattern. And so this is what John Michel did. This was John Michel's vision. And Megalithomania is basically an extension of that. It's an opening to people who have been doing this kind of research and related research involving megaliths and megalithic knowledge to speak in front of quite a big audience. It's between about 100 and 120, and its capacity, it's the infamous assembly rooms in the very heart of Glastonbury, which each year forms the backdrop of this venue. And so this year, once again, everybody convened, and there were some extremely wonderful speakers.
Yeah, I was looking at the lineup, and I really it looks like a wonderful conference. I think it would be so much fun, actually, to participate and to listen into some of this stuff. Our friend John Major Jenkins was there talking about the Mayas, I believe, right, in 2012?
Absolutely. John Major Jenkins was the keynote speaker on Saturday evening.
And Robert Temple talking about Egyptian Dawn.
Absolutely.
And Samos Manigich talking about the Bosnian pyramids. That's a subject that has been very close to your heart. Anything new on the pyramids? Anything new from Sam? Anything that surprised you?
Yes. In short, Sam was lecturing the last time at Megalithomania in 2008, when I was lecturing on crystal skulls, because at that moment in time, the the infamous Indiana Jones movie, which some hate and some like, was just arriving on the scene. It was having its premiere at the Cannes Film Festival the very weekend, actually, when the Megalithomania Conference was on at that moment in time. And it was really a period when Sam was breaking out the news about the Bosnian pyramids to audiences in the Western world in a very direct manner, because up until that moment in time, really the only thing which people had been hearing were very, very badly written or very badly distorted accounts of what was happening in Bosnia. And what he did on Sunday afternoon was basically provide an update as to what has been happening to the Bosnian pyramids between 2008 and 2011. And the Bosnian pyramid complex is very complex, but he gave an overview basically for the first time, because he has that distance now between him, of how the scientific community was reacting in 2008 and in what kind of a battle he is. And there's this old saying which says that, you know, at first they will laugh at you and will discard you, then they will accept you, and then the third thing, they will take it as self-evident that whatever you said was true all along. And Sam is definitely in the second stage, because the opponents, to some extent, are becoming quiet. Because here's the situation in 2008. The discovery of these pyramids had happened in 2006, and Sam was trying to get funding and trying to get the world interested in what was happening. And he wanted this to be a very open, kind of new approach to exploring what he felt he had discovered. And what he found was that when he reached out to the scientific communities of Western Europe, he got an astonishing no. And he went into detail as to what was happening. And it is extraordinary. For example, he was talking about the extraordinary boycott and the pressure applied by local scientists who were so set against what he was doing that they contacted the likes of Anthony Harding, who was president of the European Association or Federation of Archaeologists at that time. And Harding came, looked at the pyramids for about 10 minutes from the back of a taxi, and said, all of these things are natural. There is nothing to this. And he made sure that anybody who was going to help Sam Osmanagić was actually going to not have a job in any archaeological dig anywhere in Europe. So Sam was confronted in 2008 and earlier, but in 2007, with this idea that nobody from the Western world was going to help him because there was an active boycott. Basically, scientists were saying, we don't care what you're doing. We're not going to help you because this is just the way it is. They were shutting him out. And so he went to the Middle Eastern world, to the Arab world, and looked to the world of Egyptologists. And he wrote to Zahi Hawass, and Zahi Hawass and his department sent him a geologist, Mohammed Al-Barakat. And the lovely Mohammed stayed there for 42 days, and on the 43rd day there was an international press conference which basically said, what is here present in ancient Egypt, in Bosnia, is on par with what is in ancient Egypt, namely a man-made pyramid. However, this one is bigger than anything we have in ancient Egypt. And when that press conference got to the attention of Dr. Zahi Hawass and the other of the archaeologists, Dr. Hawass denied ever having spoken to Sam Osmanagić. To which the good Sam Osmanagić took out the letter and published the letter in a very open way and said, but Mr. Hawass, this is the letter I received from you. Mr. Barakat did not appear here through magic. He was sent from the Egyptians. And ever after, Dr. Hawass shut up.
Now, well, I wouldn't go that far. Dr. Hawass never shuts up. But he made us stop talking about the Bosnian pyramids.
Yes. So what he did next was he looked at other Egyptologists, because he realized that really it was with Egyptologists that he was only going to get somewhere. And so what happened was, by August 2008, when Sam was organizing the first international conference on the Bosnian pyramids, the so-called ICBP, he had a about 30 Egyptologists, which included the likes of Ibrahim Ali, who is the head of Heliopolis University, Dean of Archaeology of Heliopolis University. It also included the likes of Ala Shaheen, who at that time was the Dean of Archaeology for Cairo University, and who was briefly supposed to be the successor to Zahi Hawass as Minister of Antiquities before Hawass was given that position again six months ago. The person responsible for the Alexandrian Library was there. There were professors from the Ukraine, from Russia, from Hungary, from various places. Top experts who he could get were there. The only ones missing were Western European archaeologists, American archaeologists, because they had decided to boycott this event. And this was a situation in 2008. So what has happened between 2008 and 2011? Well, the fact that so many Egyptologists are there, and the fact that it has to be said, so many archaeologists are employed. Some young archaeologists say, we don't care. We're not getting a job by keeping to the proper path as to how we should be doing it. So we are going to do what we want to do. And so these archaeologists, some of them young, with little to no experience, but also some who have had quite a good reputation and just feel that it is time to break this stupidity which is reigning in Western Europe, are now beginning to come. And amongst the latter category is a woman from Italy who's now leading these scientific excavations, and basically was willing to, you know, do a pay cut from 3,000 euros a month to 600 euros a month, just so that she could be involved and be involved in the work in Bosnia. He has also continued to receive top visiting professors and archaeologists, geologists and the like. But specifically what he's been doing is, with the fact that he is digging in these tunnels and he's receiving samples, he's been able to send these out to universities, laboratories, and in blind testing, these results are coming back. And so what we're beginning to see is that the stones which are made, the coating basically of the Pyramid of the Sun, which the good Dr. Robert Schock has claimed and continues to proclaim as being completely normal and completely natural. Six universities have now all said that this is artificial and is a conglomerate, i.e. a type of cement, and have given identical conclusions, as you would expect, for how these blocks have been formed. So we know that the coating of the Pyramid of the Sun is definitely artificial. The Pyramid of the Moon continues to pose some challenges, but there is good progress there. But the most interesting work is done in the tunnel complex, or as Sam calls it, the labyrinth, which he has been digging for up to 3 years now. 3 years ago, he had penetrated 150 meters, and each meter he found was completely covered with soil. Basically, they had flooded these tunnels, and kind of a sea sandish kind of residue had settled and completely filled in these corridors. Well, after about 200 to 250 meters, depending on which tunnel you're in, because again, this is a labyrinth, Sam has begun to find corridors where there is no more blockage, and basically the corridors there are open. And he has also found, rather than the normal kind of, you know, 2 meter to 2 meters 50 high, roughly man can walk into easily corridors, there are now larger aspects. Some of them go as high as 5 meters, so 5 yards really high. And he's penetrated, as I think I said already, 500 meters into this tunnel complex. And he's beginning to see how they all connect and how some rooms have like 8 passageways going in various directions. And the interesting thing is, of course, that he's still almost a mile away from the Pyramid of the Sun complex. So he has a very long way to go. But this is a man who last year got recognized as leading, or rather as having organized, the largest archaeological excavation on the planet. 250 people over the summer last year were involved in working on the pyramid complex. And so it's officially recognized, or it was officially recognized last year, as the largest scientific archaeological dig happening anywhere on the planet. And so he is in the second stage whereby the mood is slowly changing. People are beginning to see that what he is doing has got scientific validity, and that each time, whenever he submits something to a museum, it comes back with positive, not to a museum, but to a university laboratory for analysis. It comes back with positive results, namely that the Bosnian pyramids are real and that what is happening there is something which is truly of interest, not just to the local people, but probably to the entire world. And so this is what he's really been saying in this conference, that, you know, the work continues and that it will continue once again this year, and that he's actually planning the second ICBP conference in September of this year. And if anybody wants to visit the Bosnian pyramids, this ICBP conference in September really is a good, opportune moment to be confronted with the latest findings, which will be done within, you know, the comfort of a hotel room, conference room. But at the same time, around that event, there will be in-depth getting familiar with every little site of the Bosnian pyramid complex. And in the upcoming weeks, Sam is going to make more and more announcements, but already you can go to some of his websites, and I will put those links up on our website, thespiritrevolution.com, so people who want to go to Bosnia and want to experience these pyramids, and who are free in September, that they can definitely do so.
I am looking at Sam's website right now, actually, and it really is astonishing. And I'm going to put up the link that I'm looking at as well, because it's just some incredible pictures of the Valley of the Pyramids. And it's, I don't know, I mean, I am not an archaeologist and I am not an expert, but I have eyes and I have a brain, and I can look at these photographs and say, how can you look at any of these things and say that this is not man-made? I mean, you can see the terracing, you can see the cut work, you can see the creation of the blocks. You know, the aerial shots of the Pyramid of the Sun are, you know, identical in shape to the Great Pyramid. I mean, it's really quite an extraordinary thing to look at. And I also wanted to say that you don't just attend conferences. You have been to Bosnia and you have, you know, visited these sites. What do you have to say about what you have seen and experienced and felt? Most of all, what have you felt when you were in these places?
Well, I mean, to actually start with the feeling, there are two aspects to this feeling. One of them is that when you're walking around Visoko, which is the town, roughly about an hour's drive outside of Sarajevo, when you're in Visoko, the site in the middle, the town in the middle of this pyramid complex, you feel like you are... Like, you know, you realize what it, Howard Weiss or these great explorers who walked around Egypt and explored the pyramids would have felt like. And this is something which I hope is still there, but definitely was there 4 and 3 years ago when I was there. Yes, I spent an awful lot of time in 2008 and also some time in 2007 because I was one of the first people who really kind of like felt that Sam should be given a proper airing. As to what he was doing at that time, and I wrote a number of articles which appeared pretty much around the world, specifically in Nexus at that time. And what was happening, and what was happening there was, you know, really the sense of excitement, this idea that something was real. And again, you are a very big proponent of folklore. Of like, you know, this idea that the locals know far more than a visiting academic who either comes or stays in his armchairs and discusses what is happening somewhere else. Well, these locals, they were aware of the fact that there were tunnels everywhere. Whenever they were trying to do something in their cellar, like digging for a cellar or doing something, they realized that, you know, something was not quite right. There were tunnels there. At one time, a factory was being erected, and they had to pour in concrete truck after concrete truck of cement because they were hitting parts of this underground complex. And in fact, one of Sam's worst nightmares is the moment when his crew will come across this concrete all in the underground tunnels, because he really doesn't know what he will have to do at that moment in time. But they know about these things, and they knew, for example, that the KTK tunnels, which is a tunnel complex which sits just outside of a factory, a local big factory called KTK, and they knew for quite a few years that there was this tunnel complex there as well. During the Second World War, but specifically during the trouble which Bosnia had about 15 years ago, there was a bomb which was, you know, not necessarily intended for Visoko, because all the bombs went to Sarajevo, but there was some warfare going on there. And in fact, the top of the Pyramid of the Moon is still quite a bit covered with shells from that war, which is also another reason why excavations there are so slow. And areas like what Sam has called the Pyramid of the Dragon hasn't even been explored, because there really the intensity of ammunition from the Bosnian War is really so intense. But in that war, a bomb dropped onto the Pyramid of the Sun. And when it did, it created this gigantic echo, this bell-like ringing. And it was felt throughout the town, and this was, you know, like so unlike anything with the sound of the other bombs which were dropped on the town, and so they realized that once again something was special there. Everybody in the area always knew that there was something special about it, and there are even descriptions going back to the 1960s of a person writing in a book which never received any attention whatsoever, that this person felt that what we were faced with here in Visoko was a pyramid. So what kind of, like, you know, do I feel and what do I think is the most important things? Well, there are various sides, but really my love has to be the biggest one of all, which is the Pyramid of the Sun. It is so majestic, it is so beautiful, it is so overpowering. That it just kind of, like, you know, you stare at it and you just kind of like, you go, wow. And what is actually interesting is not something which very many people see, because the Pyramid of the Sun actually has a ramp leading to it and up to it on one side. Because this is relatively private property, and the person and the people living there do not want to have hundreds of thousands of visitors, because 50,000 visitors each year come to Visoko now to see the pyramids. This particular site doesn't really get shown so much, and there's another aspect which I'll come back to shortly. But here, Sam, in the very first season of excavation, did some digs, and what he uncovered there were perfectly beautiful artificial slabs, who basically, imagine you have a platform which goes from the bottom of the valley up to a part of the pyramid, and it is like a procession which basically was concreted over and so was in stone. Well, the sides are like slanted, and in this case it is hewn stones, but the sides of these stones are cut, and each stone is cut. So this is something which you realize when you see it, that this cannot simply be artificial. This is man-made. The reason, however, why Sam has not been able to do more excavations there is when he went public with this, the local archaeologists, who at that time were vehemently opposed to him, made sure that there was an injunction against Sam doing any kind of digging in that area. So basically, when you are confronted with the evidence that tells you that you are wrong, you just make sure that no further evidence of that kind can be seen. And that's actually a funny coincidence, because in September of 2008, the University of Kiel, I believe, had sent a number of skeptical researchers in there, and they were quickly going to disprove this illusion which Sam had. And so they dug somewhere very far away, and what they found was actually a very small artifact. And it just so happens that the very small artifact which they found is a pyramid-like object with a flattened top, just like the Pyramid of the Sun. So rather than finding evidence against Sam, they actually found evidence somewhat in favor of Sam. And, you know, when you are there, you just are surrounded by these things. And sure, you know, like there are things like there's a very interesting temple called Vratichna. And there are gigantic, huge stone blocks. And I have no idea what those mean, and neither does Sam. But when it comes to the Temple of the Moon, the Temple of the Sun, and the Temple of the Dragon, for example, we know that the tops of these pyramids, when you measure them, form a perfect equidistant equilateral triangle. So all of these things cannot just happen by nature. The sides of the Pyramid of the Sun are perfectly aligned north, south, east, west. All of these things, kind of like, you know, the shadow, for example, of the sun, the shadow which the sun cast rather at the equinoxes and the summer solstices is very intricate. And on one day, and I need to look at my notes, but from memory I think it's the sunset on the summer solstice, the sun, the shadow, and the sun and the, sorry, the sun casts a shadow of the Pyramid of the Sun and makes it fall completely to one side of the Pyramid of the Moon, whereas the sunset on, I think, August 21st makes the top shadow of the Pyramid of the Sun drop exactly on the top of the moon. And these things just show you that there is an intelligence behind anything to do with this pyramid complex.
And what's your theory and Sam's theory on age, on dating, and how they interact with the other pyramids on the planet in terms of time frames?
Well, Sam is very much more progressive on that than I am. I would say that there is a very cozy, comfortable place which is called Old Europe, which is precisely that catchment area. It is what today is Yugoslavia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Serbia. And a very proficient archaeologist called Maria Gimbutas wrote a very beautiful series of books on this culture called Old Europe. And it is within the catchment area. The Visoko is within the catchment area. We know, for example, that the Visoko was one of the first places in Bosnia-Herzegovina where agriculture was done. The very valley there was the first place where agriculture was practiced in a period between roughly 6000 BC all the way to 2500 BC. Now, some of the evidence coming from the tunnels also suggests that the tunnel complex was abandoned around that period of time, around 2000 to 2500 BC. However, Sam has also found that there is some wood has been found in this tunnel complex, which gives a staggering date of 18,000 years. So some extremely big dates are being shown, and Sam, you know, Sam is at this moment in time just giving these dates. He's including the big dates, but he's also giving the conservative dates. But at this moment in time, definitely there is a very consistent framework, if you want, which says that there was a civilization there in 6000 BC. It's a civilization which we know interacted with the Sumerian culture, and we know that the Sumerian culture then began to build pyramids as well. So there's a very, again, consistent little picture emerging, which isn't necessarily that controversial. The only controversial bit is that this civilization in 6000 to 4500 BC was able to work with cement and was able to build the biggest pyramid known on planet Earth.
So is it the usual academic and archaeological jealousy that creates all these obstacles for Sam? I mean, I will never understand that, of course, because for me, why we don't want to know as much as possible about something that is this fascinating and that can teach us so much about our history is something that I just will never be able to grasp. But I'm surprised when I hear that someone like a Dr. Robert Schock has come out against the authenticity of the man-made structure. When you look at Schock, it's someone who has made such controversial claims about the Sphinx and seems to be, you know, certainly ready to step out on a limb when it comes to combating traditional perspectives on archaeology, at least in Egypt. Why do you think that someone like Schock Because I think he's a good example here. Obviously, they're much, you know, bigger, and there are far more people at play here. But I think I want to use Shock as an example, because I'm trying to get my head around this. Why do you think someone like Shock, who has gained a name for himself as being controversial, not being afraid to challenge traditional archaeological dating, why do you think he has been so hard-nosed about accepting Bosnia?
Well, it's actually not the only thing which Shock has been skeptical about. About 10 years ago, Graham Hancock came with a book on how basically, you know, there were structures underneath the water which showed that the water levels had been different at points in time in the past, and at that moment in time, Hancock was using specifically the underground structures of Yonaguni as a very clear example of what this was. And when you're confronted with Yonaguni, you will find that, you know, when you dive, you are confronted with structures which look completely artificial. And there were two strands of people who went there. Shock went diving, apparently very quickly. Came up and wrote a report saying, no, this is all natural, there is nothing to be done here, nothing to be seen here, let's move on. However, in 1999, I have unfortunately forgotten the name of this person, but he was the leading Japanese geologist, completely fully accredited by universities. And he spoke actually at the Eric von Däniken's Ancient Astronaut Conference in Gelsenkirchen on this very subject. And he was adamant that this structure was completely artificial. So the idea that Shock is this liberal, I think is to some extent a bit of a misnomer. As you said, I think when it comes to Egypt, he is willing to go there. And I also think his preoccupation and his interest in Egypt, which he's written about in a number of places, I think is why he is unwilling to look at too many alternative things and accepts them as artificial outside of the realm of Egypt. I could go on as that, but I would just conclude and say that Shock is a man who sincerely loves Egypt and maybe a bit too much.
I understand. Okay, so staying with megalithomania a minute before we transition, one of the subjects that is very, very dear to our hearts was featured there this weekend, and that is the subject of the extraordinary stone alignments in Karnak in Brittany. Can you talk a little bit about what came up about Brittany over the weekend?
Yes, absolutely. Well, I became enthralled by the findings and the lecture of a British expat who has lived just outside of Karnak since 1986. It was love which took him there. And it was not just you know, the love for a woman, it was also the love for the Karnak alignments, which resulted in something which was truly extraordinary. His name is Howard Crowhurst. And again, we will put up some links. He has written one book in English and two books in French, a first edition of a book and a second edition of a book. And he's working diligently in getting everything in print. But as you know, these things take time, specifically the approach which he is doing. And the approach he's been doing is extremely mathematical. But there is a simplicity to the result, if that makes sense. And obviously, because it's mathematical, it requires a visual interface, for which radio isn't the best means. So I kind of like have to jump to the conclusions, which is basically that what he has discovered is that the temple complexes of Karnak, these stone rows, are aligned to solar and lunar events. But that in so doing, when you think of Karnak and just see these rows, and you think, okay, they put some rows here in a line, and then somewhere else they did something more, and yes, indeed, they're aligned to the sun. No, what he's found is extremely detailed mathematical planning. They have mapped every square inch, so to speak, of that region. And once they had planned it out, they basically made a series of squares. And then they began to use these squares. For example, three or four squares, they would create a diagonal, and it's along this diagonal that they would make a series of stone rows, and then they would play with another kind of squares, and then they would make another stone alignment there. And the same thing can be traced for the cromlechs and the dolmens and all the other megalithic things. Howard Crowhurst goes further and says that the megalithic units which are used in this are the so-called megalithic yard, which is something which Alexander Thom in the 1970s proposed. And basically what Thom said in the 1970s was that all the megalithic sites in Europe seem to have used this megalithic yard as a common unit of measurement. So in short, whether you had a megalith in megalithic complex in Scotland or in Brittany, Thom said that these had been used by the same standard, that the same standard of measurement had been incorporated into them. Well, Howard has gone one step further and has actually shown that the way the complexes were built includes far more consistency than previously done. For example, that things like Newgrange, the Ring of Brodnar on the Orkneys, and some other sites, including the stone circle of Avebury, all have stone circles, and that the diameter of these stone circles is 50 megalithic rods, which is basically 2.5 or a 2.5 times 50 megalithic yards. So what he's discovering is not just in Carnac, but everywhere in Western Europe, which is his area of interest, that there is this extraordinary mathematical understanding. And so seeing that in a presentation really was just so stunning and so beautiful that people really are beginning to realize that we are once again unearthing and discovering a completely new dimension to the megalithic civilization, and it is one which is truly extraordinary. And Howard has so much material, not just about megaliths, but also about the beautiful and wonderful labyrinth in Chartres, that I'm going to continue meeting up with him and helping him any which way I can in bringing his knowledge and his conclusions to a wider audience. Hopefully also in a way that people understand without the complete complexity of the underlying mathematics involved.
Well, count me in both of those missions, particularly simplifying the mathematics for those of us with more liberal arts minded brains. But I do want to say in all seriousness that it's so important that people like this, like Howard Crowhurst, who have truly devoted their lives, 25 years of just intense, committed study. You know, these people need to be heard. And this idea that, they don't get any attention because they don't have a PhD after their name, or they're not good at taking tests and therefore don't have a tenured position at a university somewhere, is something that we really combat all the time. And people who listen to us regularly know that we rage against this, that I truly believe that the greatest experts in the world are not most of the time the people who are given credit for being the experts of the world. It is people like this who have individually and personally given everything, risked everything, devoted everything to really gain the greatest, and most extraordinary firsthand information by immersing themselves in the work. And that's what's so important about conferences like Megalithomania. That's what's so important about shows like this. And I think that we just need to, at all times reaffirm and be strong on this commitment to help people like that get their work out to the broadest audience possible, because there are so many people doing such important and exciting, this is super cool, exciting stuff when you start digging into it. And I think that people will love it. It kind of goes back to what you're doing on Ancient Aliens. Ancient Aliens has been the big surprise on television of these last couple of years because it has been so explosively successful. Well, I think it's because the people are really ready to start hearing alternative theories. People have opened their minds to the idea that there's a lot more going on in the world than we've ever been told. And whether that's history or archaeology or any of those things, it just happens to be true. So I think that the beauty of what's happening in media today, and that it is more open, and that a couple of big publishers don't control all the information in the world anymore, is that there are so many avenues to get work like this out there. So I am very excited about learning more about him and about a number of these other people who were there. Carmen Bolter, who was involved with the Pyramid Code, and I know that she talked about matriarchal societies and prehistory. She's someone I want to get on the show. She was phenomenal, right?
Absolutely. She unfortunately couldn't be physically present there due to some personal circumstances, but she gave a wonderful presentation via Skype. And definitely getting Carmen on the show is one of our immediate missions for the show.
And let's transition a little bit here into another subject that is incredibly near and dear to our hearts and something that you are working on with a lot of passion right now for a lot of important reasons. And that is the subject of 2012. Both our friends and great experts on the subject of 2012, John Major Jenkins and Jeff Stray, were with you in Glastonbury. What kind of things were you guys cooking up together?
Well, actually, it's interesting to kind of see where Jeff and John are. And to some extent, they were a bit down. And Jeff Jeff basically feels that 2012 is now pretty much well-known out there. So he considers his mission about making 2012 famous complete. And to some extent, I guess I can agree with that. And he just wants to take a year off and hopefully go around the world and see many beautiful sites and visit many beautiful things. John had the key lecture on Saturday evening, and he basically said how, you know, he has been in a number of television shows, specifically early on when 2012 was still coming out, and he always said that 2012 wasn't about the end of the world. And he actually said that each time this message that 2012 wasn't the end of the world was always cut. It always ended up on the floor. And so he said how at one point in time it was a Discovery or History Channel documentary, and he actually tried to get it into the contract in the agreement that if he said that, you know, this wasn't about the end of the world, but it was about social change and various other things, that when he said this, that it should actually be included in the documentary. Now, obviously, as you know, Hollywood and any TV producer doesn't like to be told what they have and should be doing. So actually, they declined this clause, and John wasn't interviewed. But basically, John was very disappointed with the fact that he has done so much work on the astronomical importance of 2012, on getting the idea out there that 2012 is not something which is just a blank canvas. Some people who say that 2012 is about the end of the world also pretend that the Mayans no longer exist, which is blatantly false. There are Mayans, hundreds of thousands of them, living in Mexico, specifically Guatemala, and other countries of Central America. They also pretend that we do not know what 2012 would be all about, which is, again, not true. The Mayans, we have archaeological records, we have anthropological records in the sense of writings which were taken after the Spanish invasion, the Spanish conquest of that place, which was written down by visiting historians, and who wrote down what the Mayans at that moment in time believed. And all of this has to do with the fact that the Mayans believed that 2012 is not the end of the world. It is the end of an age. It is the end of a world. But what they mean with world is the end of an era, because they see time as a somewhat cyclical, or, it's very much like a project plan. Anybody who's ever seen a project plan knows that there are periods in which you have to do things, but there's also this thing about milestones. Well, the Mayans see 2012 as a milestone, whereby they believe that that man, together with the gods, make an inventory of the situation of the planet Earth, of mankind, and then propose for the next period of time what the fate should be of mankind. And basically, with fate, what they mean is where mankind should focus on. And pretty largely spoken, they feel that the first three ages, which happened before, was all about human physical evolution, and that the fate of mankind in 3114, when this age began, was all to do with spiritual development. And is it just a coincidence that roughly this 3000 age is when you see civilization blooming everywhere? It's, you know, yes, there were civilizations before, and we've just been speaking about old Europe, but so many more after the 3000 mark enter the race, so to speak. And so it has been like that ever since. And so that is what the Mayan message is. And it's a message which I am trying to get out there as well. And you know, my ebook, which was launched just today, is another means of trying to get it out there to the masses that 2012 is not about the end of the world. It is about social change. It is about taking reflection as to where we are as a human race in a very spiritual manner, and rather than just going along on a daily basis, to really set out a plan for, you know, what I would say the rest of each individual's life, but also for mankind for a, you know, for an, a good number of years, to kind of like see what we would try to want to achieve for the greater good of mankind and the planet.
You did have a wonderful book on 2012 just released in the last 24 hours. It is an e-book. It is called The Mystery of 2012, Science or Fiction. And I want to talk about it because I think it's extremely important and it's very exciting for a number of reasons. One, I know a lot of us are saturated with 2012 material. I mean, you know, we have 50 books in the house on them. And I know people are like, okay, enough already, we get it. But there is so much information that's not just about that date, but it's about, you know, where we came from, who we are, and where we're going. And the way that you present it in this book is so interesting. And it covers so many aspects of 2012, everything from, you know, the really scientific stuff, the time wave zero stuff, to what was really going on, not just with the Mayans, but with the Hopi and with the other traditions. But I also wanted to mention that this is an extremely pioneering project that you are working on. You are doing something with the partner in the group that you're working on with these books that has never been done before. Embedding video in ebooks, for example. There are things that are happening in your ebook that are completely new to the publishing business. And it's so exciting to me. Can we talk about that for a minute?
Absolutely. Well, you know, I have worked in the this revolution of big publishers trying to move away from print to online. And basically what everybody is doing is finding cheap ways to convert a paper product as quickly as possible into an electronic product. But it's only what you get in the print edition, which is, you know, sometimes not even with the color images, so to speak. It's still with the black and white images from the print edition. So that is not good. That is not something which I feel really adds anything to the digital revolution which is supposedly happening. And in last year, the iPad really broke through and made rapid change into this ebook market, and gave new opportunities. From what we can gather is this: when the technicians who were doing this tried to embed video in their ebook, you know, from the model, the so-called the electronic formatting, this is perfectly doable. But when they were trying to do this for the iPad, they found that there were some challenges and that it just didn't render as it should or at all. So they had to contact the people at Apple and try to get them some of their involvement. And from the reaction from the people at Apple, it seems that this is indeed the first time ever that somebody has embedded video into an ebook. And the video is actually each chapter has got about 3 to 4 minutes of me giving further information in an oral fashion as to what is happening there. So yes, this is not just an ebook. This is also an e-video, and each chapter. To just give you an overview of what the ebook is about, it's roughly 10,000 words, so it's very small. And this is the idea. It's not meant to be long. It's meant to give the essence of 2012, what it is about, what it evolves around, what are the calendars, you know, like, it's meant to be very accessible. You have about 1,000 words per topic, like, say, Time Wave Zero. What is Time Wave Zero? Why is it so important? What do the Mayans think about 2012? What do the Mayan, the Hopi think about 2012? Are there other traditions apart from the Mayans and the Hopi, other cultures which talk about this 2012 phenomenon? And at the end of that, there is normally a reference quite often to YouTube where you can go into more depth. For example, if you are all of a sudden extremely interested in learning everything to do with Time Wave Zero or the figure that was Terence McKenna, well, you just click on there and you will be transported into YouTube where you can watch the Terence McKenna videos. And then again, each chapter also has some additional questions and sometimes a bit of a recap of where I actually talk on camera, which was filmed in January in a very cold corner of Amsterdam. But you do not see my breath being basically full of cold air.
So it's really, I mean, it's an e-book, but it's also, it's got video, it's got audio, it's got all kinds of, you know, really futuristic Jetsons kind of stuff going on in it.
Yes, and I mean, again, that is why I wanted to do this project, and it's also why I feel that, you know, this is the first of a series of mystery booklets, and the mystery booklet series, so to speak, is the first of three, which the producers, Digital Journeys, a new company, but with extremely knowledgeable people behind it, specifically a Dutch entrepreneur called Kees Segers, who is notorious in the Netherlands for his innovation. He basically was the person who did a Dutch equivalent of let's say newsaol.com, but rather than use the power of the big industry, he did it all from scratch, all on his own, and made a multi-million company from scratch. And it was always, all of his companies, he had 12 of them, always were about innovation onto the electronic pathway that is the internet. And so with the 2012 science or fiction, he continues on this path, and specifically what he now sees as his mission in life is to not just make money, so to speak, but actually to bring awareness of everything with the alternative sciences to the largest possible audience. Again, this is not written for a niche market. This is written for everybody. If you have a child who says that they don't have to do their homework because the world in 2012 is going to end, well, this ebook is going to give you all the ammunition you need in, you know, one-liners as to how you can tell your child that he should do his homework.
We have both been through that with my child and my nephew, actually, who have all said, why should I do this? The world's going to end anyway in 2012. And we have had to set them straight. So what's next? What comes after the 2012 ebook, which everyone needs to experience because it is such cool technology?
Well, the next one is likely going to be unidentified flying objects.
UFOs.
Indeed.
Modern UFOs, the current you know, wave of UFO activity, as opposed to ancient alien stuff?
It would be less ancient aliens and more UFOs. Now, of course, you know, UFOs have got this tradition that anomalous things have been seen in the sky for an awful long period of time, but it would definitely be this approach to anomalous things in the sky rather than analyzing ancient monuments like the Great Pyramid or Teotihuacan or Pumapunku and all of these things which kind of, like, you know, form the basis of the ancient alien series. It would be pretty much more aimed towards strange things seen in the sky. What do they mean? What does it involve? And kind of like showing people that things like the Roswell crash and the MJ-12 papers, which, you know, is the subject of so much Hollywood documentaries and movies and even things like The Event, which are basically, you know, making use of so much of the UFO lore, to kind of like show where this all originates from, and what is the truth about the individual elements, and how it all falls into place. So that is the next step. But first, we need to recover from the pioneering efforts of the 2012 book.
The 2012 book is super exciting, and in honor of the 2012 book, I am actually buying my first e-reader. I do not have one. I have been adamantly against getting one because I'm a bibliophile, and I have fought tooth and nail to the end of holding on to my paper. But seeing what you are doing with the 2012 book and what you and Case and their team have created is so exciting and so cool that as a reader and as a writer, I actually can't wait to start playing with one now. What do we say to people about this kind of technology who maybe aren't quite ready for it or have the same idea that I have? I mean, one of the things I want to say is I am not buying an e-reader to replace my books. Nothing will ever replace my books. I am buying one, however, to supplement what I do with my books, and I think that is a good way to do it. I think that it's still a little bit expensive. Are there inexpensive ways for people to get e-readers on their current laptops or current devices so they don't have to go out and spend hundreds of dollars so that they can avail themselves of this kind of a book?
Well, it all depends. Basically, if you have an iPhone, then you can, you know, simply go to the iBookstore and get it there. So you don't need anything. If you have an iPod Touch, you can do that. There are certain applications, and again, it depends on what kind of computer you have and what kind of operating system you have and how old your computer is. But there are technologies out there whereby you can get them. You know, there's so much information about Amazon Kindle, the Nook Reader, various other ones, the iPad. Basically, all of these things, when it gets down to it, is when you have one of them, there are applications which allow you to read the other formats as well. For example, on an iPad, you can read Kindle books. So there are things out there, but really, you know, this is a very evolving market, and I would completely agree with you that certain things, you know, a book should never go should never be abandoned. But just at the Megalithomania conference, for example, we had the lecture of Robert Temple, who said, "Hey, I have written this book called Egyptian Dawn, and it's, you know, 450 pages, and I had to create this website where all of the images had to go to and all of the drawings which I did with Illustrator, because the publisher said that it didn't fit in the book and the book would simply become too expensive." Well, guess what? For an ebook, you don't have that problem. He could have done all of those things. You know, he could have done them color. He could have inserted them specifically where you wanted them to be. And he could have incorporated all of those things and done precisely what he wanted. So it really, I think, when we're talking about the ebooks, and again, 2012 Science or Fiction is not your typical ebook. It is aimed at kind of bringing a new awareness about 2012 in a very short, direct manner. But if you are confronted with the fact that you are trying to accomplish something which is simply impossible to do on paper because of the costs involved, then, you know, the ebook market is offering a very good alternative to do that for you.
Well, I think, again, it is super exciting. I can't wait to play with it. I think that the idea of having, you know, an interactive bibliography, basically, you know, you're talking about references. You can take people directly to the references. You know, I think about this in terms of my own work and how excited I would be if in reading my books, people could be taken to the painting that I'm talking about, you know, to the space in the Palazzo Medici that I'm talking about. I mean, these are the kinds of, you know, advances in technology for reading and research that I just think the sky's the limit, and I personally can't wait to play with them.
Absolutely, and unfortunately, the limit of our hour is up.
It happens all the time. That crazy thing we call time, we can't control it. But it has been a wonderful hour, and we could talk about the megalithic stuff all day, and we will be talking about a lot more because we're going to have a number of these people on the show. We are working on getting some of them on as guests so that we can talk more in depth about their work. We can help them promote their work and help them get it out there.
But until that moment in time, for this week, this is the end of the Spirit Revolution. You can listen to us again via iTunes, or you can go to our website, thespiritrevolution.com, to hear this and any of our previous interviews, including 2012 and the likes of John Major Jenkins and Jeff Stray. But until that moment in time,
the truth against the world.